Within moments of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, life in America instantly and dramatically transformed for the duration of the war. The harbor town of Morro Bay, California, became a major training center for amphibious invasions of South Pacific Islands and the top-secret D-Day invasion of Normandy. Come along and join Edith Ross and Art Criddle as they share their recollections of the war years in Morro Bay from the perspective of young children. Afterwards, join me in Bedford, Virginia, at the National D-Day Memorial for a conversation with the director, April Cheek Messier. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We're here with Edith Ross and Art Criddle. And Edith Ross was a Criddle.
That's true, I was.
Well, who's the oldest here at the table?
I am.
What year were you born?
I was born 1934.
Yeah. And Art, you were born?
36.
Okay, so you're in charge of Art, then. You can tell him what to do, right?
Yes, right. They say my brother is a nice guy, and I say it's because I tenderized him.
There you go.
Yeah, right.
So you guys were young pups when our world changed horrifically and dramatically in one day. Let's go back in time. It's December 6, 1941. Mm-hmm. It's Saturday. What were you guys doing?
Living out here in Morro Bay, there was nothing but us. And so we were probably just running around, huh?
That's what we were doing, running around. Of course, I wasn't that old, so.
So now it's Sunday, December 7th. It's in the morning, probably mid-morning, and the news from KVEC comes over the radio that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin from Washington, D.C. At 7:55 this morning, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor from the air, and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu.
When and how did you guys hear it?
In church, in Sunday school. But I remember Daddy coming home, and he had been down at the Cracker Box restaurant in Morro Bay.
Where was the Cracker Box?
It's where the Gold Tree is now. He was having coffee, having just come off the night shift.
Where did he work?
At the time he was working out on the breakwater. What was he doing, Art? What were they doing then?
First job he had out there was working on the dredge, and then the war came along.
Yeah.
And then they started quarrying the rock for the breakwater.
And so he came home, and he was just absolutely shocked. I remember him
telling us that he was at the Cracker Box.
Yeah.
If it was around 7 a.m. in the morning in Honolulu, it would have been 10 or 11 before you would have gotten the news here.
Yeah, that was about right.
And so he told you guys?
He told us, yes.
What did you think?
We were scared. I thought that it was coming here. Well, who knew anyway?
Well, it was coming here if they'd had their way.
Everybody along the California Central Coast thought and was told that there was likely to be an invasion of the Japanese right out here, right out front.
Right, yeah, that's true.
One attack hit the Montebello submarine. The first shot that they took hit the rock.
I have been told 2-3 times that one of the torpedoes literally hit and blew up Morro Rock.
Yeah, that's true.
I was told that it woke everybody up in town. Do you remember hearing that explosion?
I don't remember.
I do hear that. I do remember Daddy saying we were shook out of bed like there was an earthquake. It had to have been a huge bomb, you know, to do that.
They chased the Montebello up to Cambria.
And that's where they sunk it.
And then the Japanese submarines tried to sink the Doheny. I think it was coming out of Avila.
There was another one up here, and Dad at that time, I think, after that, he was working up there as a guard for the oil tanks. Standard Oil had some oil tanks, and he was hired on as a guard. They had the dogs, and he'd get his dog and go to perimeter. One time when he was working up there, he was on his way back, and it was foggy. He almost hit the bow of the ship, and he couldn't figure out why that ship was over the highway. He almost hit it. Turns out that this captain was chased by the subs, and he put it right in on the rocks without hurting the bottom.
Grounded the tanker right on the shore.
Yeah.
Right out here.
Point.
Yeah.
The next, when the sun come up and whatnot, everybody was out there wondering how in the world he got that thing in there without hurting the, well, they almost sunk it getting it off.
It was a full-size oil tanker.
Oil tanker, yeah.
Our dad had lots of jobs, and he was probably doing that while he was doing this, too, maybe, you know, doing this at night.
Yeah, he was at night up there. I know he filled in. He worked down on the abalone boat for Bill Pierce, for 3 or 4 months. Then he went to work for Standard Oil. That was it.
You forget, Art, he was doing more than one thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think he was busy at the Rock all during the war.
Yeah, well, see, they started that quarry down there to make a submarine base. And then they switched over during the middle of the war to landing craft. They had the Navy base there.
There are myths, legends, and lore about Morro Bay that people hear. And part of it has to do with you, Art. And there was a Criddle House.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's on Dad's.
Okay.
Dad built it.
On North Morro Bay. And the story is that your dad was able to get the tailings from Morro Rock and built that building out of Morro Rock stone. Is that true?
Well, the story behind that is that when they were blasting, Dad come to the supervisor and says, "Do you mind if I take some rock after work because I want to build a fence?" Well, 33 months later, before the job went down, the super asked him, "What are you building, a wall of China?" And it turned out he was building a house, of course, yeah.
So today, people driving along North Morro Bay can see a part of Morro Bay's history and your family history.
The original design has changed a little bit because of the additions they did out on the front. He did all by hand.
Did he do that during the war?
Yeah, he'd work on the rock during the day and then come back and work at night.
All right, well, let's go back in time. It's World War II. What changed in your lives?
Well, I remember how we couldn't have the lights on. And
blackouts, yeah.
Yeah, blackouts. And then there was always a warden coming around. And we didn't have sewers, and so we had septic tanks. And Daddy, we had a little light. Remember that little light up at the top of the ceiling?
Yeah,
what did that mean? It was...
It needed pumping.
It needed pumping. And so the warden saw that from outside and came and told him he had to turn that damn thing off, you know.
In those months subsequent to Pearl Harbor, for quite a while, you all thought that any day that there could be a landing force of Japanese right here in North Morro Bay.
Well, they brought the army out here almost immediately and set up their defenses, you know, and then they put in the gun emplacements and they put in shore batteries along the coast there.
And that's right out here, right in North Morro Bay. Somebody told me it was near the cloisters.
There was one at the cloisters. There's one down by the high school. And if memory serves me right, there's one or two in between those. Were big gun emplacements for that time.
Are there any concrete foundations or anything left?
No, there was long after the war, but not now. It's all gone.
And you had soldiers patrolling, walking up and down the beach, and spotters.
There was a division of soldiers stationed at the end of San Jacinto.
Yeah.
Somebody told me that there was a black detachment that was stationed there, and they were segregated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were, and they were supposed to stay on that side of the highway. Really rather awful, wasn't it? That they weren't allowed to come to this side, you know.
And somebody said they were not allowed to come to town on shore.
No, they were all segregated. Of course, we didn't know any different, but...
They were stationed right around where the high school is?
No, they took over the cloisters.
Okay.
And all those little streets, those sandalwood and all that, had a bunch of little barracks-type buildings on it, military buildings, all along there. The air raid shelter was from San Jacinto, that was the corner of it. Yeah, down north of that, there was an air raid shelter there for them.
Did you ever see the air raid shelter? Was it dug underground?
Yeah. Of course, as a little kid, it was pretty big, but probably wasn't that big.
It went from one end of the block to the other.
Yeah.
And, of course, when we were playing in it, it could have caved in any day, you know. But no one knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
Certainly our parents didn't.
Things started to change in Morro Bay in the harbor really quickly. Tractors showed up, bulldozers. There was no Embarcadero. At the bluffs, it went straight down to the bottom of the bluff, and that was the bay, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the tide came and went, and our grandmother lived right on the top of the bluff. And the water was right below, and we walked down there, and when the tide was out, playing those little sand dunes, you know. But,
The Embarcadero was a mistake, though.
Oh, you think so? Why?
Yeah, what happened is they brought some guys in to blast for them, and they drilled up there, and they didn't do the drilling right. And it blew out instead of imploding, it exploded. Did you remember that? We were out in the front yard. Bill Pierce was out there with Dad talking. They heard the alarm go off, and then they heard the two-minute alarm, and then it blasted. And we could actually see the rocks rolling off the rock.
You're talking about Morro Rock they were blasting.
Yeah, for the jetty. And a lot of that debris is now the Embarcadero.
Really, huh?
And they had to put it somewhere.
Yeah,
right. Uh-huh.
How has the rock physically changed in shape pre-World War II, post-World War II, or post-blasting?
The first jetty was 1896 or 98, and that was the first time they quarried the rock. Now, where they quarried that, I don't know, but I do know that they started on the north side, and they didn't like that rock. So then they come to the east side, I guess, and that's where they took most of it.
Today, where you see divots and more fresh-looking rock, that's where they took it out.
I asked him one time, how much of the rock disappeared, and he says about 5 acres.
Wow.
Whether that's just an estimate that he brought up, or you've got to know my dad.
Would it be fair to assume that that parking lot area, when you come out to the rock,
where that rock for the plaque is, probably the rock was short of that, but it's out there someplace.
Okay, so it came pretty close to that plaque, and now it's...
That's my guess. I don't remember. I don't know whether you do or not.
No, I don't remember. And Daddy ended his career there as a cable splicer, and so he was down on that flat area then. And
he had a shack down there, and one time they blasted. I think it was when that... all that debris come down, but the only thing he found in his shack afterwards was the vise.
Wow.
He had an overhead vise. And he says, I finally found that, because, boy, that was worth something.
So it blew it up.
Yeah, it just his shack was gone.
Okay, so let's get back to Morro Bay Harbor and that transformation of the Embarcadero. All of a sudden, the Navy, their CBs, they're building piers and training facilities. What did you see? What did you notice?
I don't remember noticing too much happening there.
Well, we weren't allowed to go downtown very much, you know, and it was more toward the end of the war that we were able to go down and see some of the stuff. I remember going to the base to watch a movie with some friends, but...
Camp San Luis?
No, they had a...
Camp Morro Bay. What was it called?
I remember years ago seeing some archival drawings, and it showed some structures near where PG&E power plant is today. And I swear, I remember reading Camp Morro.
Oh,
did you? But
well,
you never.
It could have been because the Army engineers were in charge of the quarry and then the breakwater. So it could be a camp rather than a.
Exactly, because a camp denotes an Army installation. Mm-hmm. In Navy would be station or Navy base.
Well, where was the Navy? Because
the Navy was there because the swimming pool was located just east, well, about the entrance of the PG&E plant is where they had a big guy. I think it was an Olympic size because they were training the sailors there.
Well, I do know that the captain of the naval detachment, he lived up on the hill near where the vets hall is today, and his house is still there.
Not surprised. Yeah.
And there were barracks up there. Mm-hmm. So it would follow that their administration headquarters building would have been probably somewhere. What's the name of the street where the vets hall?
Surf and Scott, I think. Or Surf.
Yeah, right.
So it would follow that somewhere right around there, I would think, would be the headquarters.
They worked with the Army base out here at
Camp San Luis, and then they brought troops in for training from Camp Roberts, I understand.
Right. That was their last training before they went overseas.
So you had to have noticed this all of a sudden influx of Army guys and Navy guys everywhere.
Yeah. Our parents had a little auto court down here.
Where was the auto court?
Okay. You know where the Beach Bistro was? That was the house we lived in, too. Our grandparents built that in the 20s. Okay. And it was between that and the Crittle House. Yeah, it was just six little
years. Main Street was the highway. That was Highway 1. Yeah. And it was narrow, too. And the trucks, we used to yell at the soldiers going by in the trucks. You remember that.
Oh, yeah. Well, there must have been a cavalry batch of them, too, because remember, they used to go by on their horses, and they went for hours. Yeah, remember when they were the black guys on their big horses, and we'd never seen black guys before. And our little sister would sit on the side of the fence and say things like, "What's buzzing, cousin?" You know. And they would grin and wave to her.
The horses, I think, for patrol down on the beach. You know.
Boy, that's true. We were playing down. I don't know if you were with us the day we were down there, and it was so foggy you couldn't see. And out of the fog came this great, big, tall black man on a great black horse. At least it seemed awful big to us. And he said, "What are you kids doing?" And we said, well, we're playing. And he said, well, you better get out of here. You're not supposed to be here, you know.
Yeah, so we took off limits. They used to unload the troops in the double pier there in Morro Bay, come around the rock, and then they'd come and take the mountain, the hill back up here.
I have photos of the naval training exercises right out front when they would take the Higgins landing craft, 20, 30 of them at a time, and come ashore right here.
Down there at the where the cloisters is now.
Do you guys remember looking out and seeing the Higgins boat landing craft?
I remember war games, too.
That's what the landings were. They'd camp down here, and then they had the bad guys up on the hill there. And then
the airplanes would come by and they'd drop.
They'd start the war.
So yeah. You remember the fighter aircraft coming 20 feet overhead, strafing these guys.
Yeah. Right, and they would strafe with something like flour, and if the flour hit you, you were dead, you know. So, there were lots going on. I mean, it seemed like an awful lot of activity to me.
Toward the end of the war, I think they relaxed and they didn't have the restrictions that they had before.
But for several years after the war, there were three disabled, what did we call them? Well, they were landing barges, but there was another name for them.
Ducks.
And we played on them for
Where were they?
They were stuck out in the sand and the shore.
Between San Jacinto and halfway down to Morro Bay.
Those to land with.
So they just left them and they rotted away.
Well, they got stuck or broke down or something.
And they hauled them off. Yeah,
well, they did.
Yeah, they had to have.
The gun emplacements were there long after the guns were gone, and eventually they disappeared. So I do know that I guess it was at the end of the war when Japan surrendered that they were shooting out the windows at the Cloister Hotel. You remember that?
The troops were?
Yeah. I mean, they were celebrating, just shooting out the windows, and they had some beautiful windows in that thing.
You've seen pictures of the hotel and everything. Yeah. Oh, it was really awful.
And then apparently the Army abandoned that. And I was there, and these guys were going in there and taking the doors off and taking the wood flooring up.
Beautiful hardwood flooring.
Well, they didn't have the building materials because of the war, so they went and scavenged it. Eventually it got so dangerous, I guess they had to tear it down.
Okay. Yeah, right.
I thought it burnt down in 47.
There was a fire. It was in 47 because I think I was still playing in it in 47, but it was... It was before 1950 that it just had disappeared. I can't really remember when
I don't remember it either. Right. What happened to it?
Straight out front here in North Morro Bay on the dunes, there were foxholes and mortar emplacements, machine gun nests. Did you guys ever see that?
I didn't see those, but see, I wasn't allowed. He would go down there because he's a boy. You know, girls didn't do.
I used to go down there, and these guys, there's a little... it's a Mexican, I don't know if it's still a Mexican restaurant, but it was Reed's Store. It has a little archway in North Morro Bay, and that was a little grocery store. Well, these guys couldn't go there. Me and my buddies would go down there, and I'd collect the money, and they'd tell me what they wanted, candy bars, Cokes, and man, some of the stuff we had to haul back. It took us quite a while.
Yeah, a little wagon, probably.
Anyway, we got it back, and of course, the tips were pretty good.
You delivered them right to the foxhole then.
Oh, yeah. I went in, climbed in, and gave them their Cokes. And one little guy, I remember one little soldier there. And looking at him, he wasn't much bigger than me, and I was little at that time. But he dumped out his canteen and filled his canteen with Cokes. And he says, don't tell anybody, because, of course, it's sugar, you know. And it, and it ruined the canteen, too, besides. But we used to go down there with him. Well, one time I went through the chow line. This little guy didn't want to eat breakfast. And they always had the lieutenant in charge of the mess line making sure everybody ate. So I went through there with a little ammunition belt and a helmet liner. And I got to the end of the line. I had my little mess tray and everything in it.
How old were you then?
Well, let's see. That had to be in the 44. So that, I was about nine years old. Anyway, I went in there, and the lieutenant looked at me, and he says, I don't think you belong to us. How old are you, son? Well, dumb me. I says, 15. I thought that's how old you had to be in the Army. And, of course, he laughed. Let me go through, yeah. Yeah, those are stories that I don't know who was with me on those.
John Wondra.
I think he was one of them, yeah. And there's a couple others, you know, but mostly John Wondra and I used to. See, but the problem is those years of being that young, it's real sketchy. Right. You just remember things that get an impression.
There's some reference in San Luis Obispo County Historical Society to something that was found right out here, right out front in North Morro Bay, and that was a Japanese shoe, yeah, that a submariner. Tell me about that story, the Japanese submariner shoe.
It was a wooden sole for the submarines. Well, what it was the night before, we had...
And when was this?
Probably 42, 43, I don't know. But we had one door in our garages that led to the back fields. And the night before this incident, the MPs and I guess the feds and everybody else came boiling in and rusted Dad out of bed, was going to arrest him for being helping the enemy. And Dad said, "What in the world are you talking about? I'm tired. I worked all day." And anyway, he says, "Well, there's a landing." And he says, "We think it came through your yard." Well, that's the only thing we could have come right through and up. Anyway, the next morning is when Dad found the boot, and he turned it in, of course. After that, they found out that there was some sympathizers living back up in the hills. You know, Dad seemed to think that was a German boot, but I don't know.
But the local consensus was that there could...
There were landings. They knew that some had infiltrated, and not just that one time.
Well, we had that Mike Mansfield that was, he was a constable, and all of a sudden he disappeared. He was gone for a week or a week and a half. Finally he came back, and man, he was tired and beat up, and Dad says, "Where in the world you been?" He says, "I can't tell you, but we almost had another war down in Oceano."
Wow.
Filipinos and the Japanese.
Was it Guadalupe or Oceano?
Well, down there someplace.
What happened? Tell us about that.
There was, I don't know.
Animosity between the two groups, the Filipinos and the Japanese. See, those farmers.
Yeah.
It'd be before they rounded them up.
Yeah. But, you know, that's something that Dad always said never got any publicity. I've never heard anything about it. Kind of kept that quiet.
What do you know about it? What happened?
It was an uprising between the two of them. They invaded the Philippines. The right. Japanese did. And these people still had relatives over there in the Philippines.
So the Filipinos in Oceano saw the Japanese farmers in Oceano as being the enemy.
As I recall, they didn't really... Well, I didn't hear of any killings or anything. But that's why Mansfield and the rest of his buddies was down there to keep the peace. Yeah, now that I think about it, because they put all these Japanese in the internment camps.
Mm-hmm. Pretty soon. Mm-hmm.
So, what did you guys know of the Japanese relocation? There were Japanese farmers that lived in our area.
I don't think we knew any. There were the Naganos who lived up Little Morro Creek Road.
No, we heard about it afterwards. See, the Japanese were just routed out, and they lost everything because they couldn't come back and pay the bills. A lot of friends of them, or the people, took over the farm.
I heard that local guys maintained their farms for them.
Saved them for the carpetbaggers, I guess you'd call them. Yeah, that was one of the black marks of the war.
Mm-hmm. So what else do you remember of World War II period here in Morro Bay?
The guys that were living in our auto court, they were family. Their wives came, and they were, oh my God, they were kids. They were 18, 19 years old now that I think about it. But we were very friendly with them, and we'd go to the movies with them and walk to town. The Bay Theater was built for them.
Edith Ross and Art Criddle, thank you guys so much.
You know, Tom, just after knowing that you were coming here, I got to thinking, some of these guys, they did their training here, and they're the ones that landed in Normandy.
Coincidentally, or maybe not, a day after visiting with Edith and Art, I traveled to Virginia, where I visited with the president of the National D-Day Memorial, the little town of Bedford. Many of the troops who trained here in Morro Bay for the amphibious landing at Normandy were among the 4,413 soldiers who were killed in the first 24 hours of the largest amphibious landing in the history of the world, where more than 150,000 Allied troops landed along a 50-mile stretch of heavily fortified French coastline. Come along and join April Cheek Messier, president of the National D-Day Memorial in Bedford, Virginia.
Hi, my name is April Cheek Messier. I am president of the National D-Day Memorial Foundation.
You've been here since the birth, haven't you?
Since. Came on just prior to our opening, June 6th of 2001.
It is fascinating that it took so long to get a memorial.
Yes, and it was because of a D-Day veteran himself who realized the need and that most people had no idea what D-Day was about. And he took it upon himself, this mission, to create a National D-Day Memorial so people would be educated and bring awareness to it.
Give us a word picture of what you would experience. I mean, here we are in a field tent.
That's right.
That's really cool.
When visitors come here, I think they really get a sense of this monument is very unique. There's a lot of symbolism here at the monument. They really get to experience what it must have been like for those troops, for example, who hit the beaches that morning, coming off those Higgins craft. You see a representation of the invasion scene where the bullets are popping in the water. It's what it looks like. And it really gives you a feel for what they must have encountered and the tremendous odds they had against them, looking at those German bunkers on the cliffs. And
you have the German bunkers
we do.
Here.
We have the German bunkers so they can get a sense of what the German bunker looked like, you know, just really what they were up against. But also they get to see a list of those who died that day. There's nowhere else in the world that has a complete listing of who died on June the 6th, 1944. It took us over a decade to do that, but there were 4,413 who died on June the 6th, and we have all of them on our memorial wall. And place else in the world does.
I think one of the most powerful and poignant aspects of visiting here are the sculptures.
Yeah. The sculptures here are very moving. We had an artist out of Kansas, Jim Brothers, who did those for us, who actually used teenage models because, you know, most of these young troops were, you know, some of them were as young as 16 years old on D-Day, 16, 17, 18 years old going in on the beaches. And so the sculptures really give you this powerful sense of what they had in front of them.
And another disconnect is you think of this memorial being in Washington, D.C. or Arlington or somewhere here. Here you are in the countryside, Bedford, Virginia.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. That is probably one of the most sobering, chilling aspects of the why.
Yes, we get asked that question a lot. This is a national monument to D-Day with an international focus as well. Why is it here in tiny rural Bedford, Virginia? Bedford, Virginia sustained the highest per capita loss of any other community in our country on D-Day. This was a tiny community of about 3,200 people, and there were 37 Bedford boys who served in Company A of the 116th Infantry Regiment, 29th Division on D-Day, who would go in on that first wave. This was the only National Guard unit to go in on the first wave on D-Day. And out of those 37 young men, 19 from Company A were killed almost within the first 15 minutes of the invasion, one from Company F, leaving a total of 20 Bedford boys on D-Day. It was devastating for this tiny community. And so Congress decided that this was a very powerful place to put the nation's monument to D-Day because Bedford is just representative of all these communities across our country who nurtured these citizen soldiers and sailors and airmen and sent them to war, and so many of them never came home.
Today, you have honor flight visits here and other pilgrimage with veterans who serve, some who were at D-Day.
Right. We have many, many veterans who come, particularly our honor flight groups on their way to D.C., stop off here, and we love having them. It's sad now because we're losing so many of our World War II veterans. The average age is 92 and 93 years old now, but how wonderful that they're still coming and they still get to experience and they get to know that we're passing on the lessons and legacy of their generation.
A few moments ago when we were walking through the parking lot, there was a guy from D-Day. Tell us about him.
That's right. That was Andrew Jack Shields, who was with the 411th AAA Battalion on D-Day. Just one of our supporters, one of our veterans who loves to come up here and talk to students, and he's actually on his way right now to talk to some students that we have.
What an honor and a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. It's a story that's very important that we pass on, and so I'm delighted and honored to be a part of it. We're about 3.5 hours from Washington, D.C. Our website is dday.org. Call us at 540-586-D-Day and get more information about us. April Cheek Messier, I am president of the National D-Day Memorial Foundation.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.